Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets where record highs were again the story of the week. He checks out the action in bonds, crude, gold, silver, the U.S. and Canadian dollars. He believes Bitcoin still has some room to go higher. InsideTrackTrading.com president Eric Haddock takes a look at the cycles connected to the stock markets, energy, currencies, and agricultural markets. Editor of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, joins us from Florida. He gives us the scoop on what he believes could cause the markets to tumble from their lofty heights. He also discusses the one economic issue the White House may not be able to overcome. He also looks into AI. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim.
How would you describe what happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, how about all-time highs again and again and again? So, you know, here we are, going from that extreme oversold condition back at the end of March, beginning of April, and now we've had this just stupendous rally, led by the NASDAQ and the semiconductors. It's been quite something. NASDAQ, as of today, we are up 26% since the lows in April. And as of today, we also have two consecutive days where our oscillator that we've designed ourselves went into overbought position. That's two consecutive days in a row. Very unusual. If we look back in the NASDAQ over the last 20 years or so, we're lucky to see this happen more than 8 or 9 times. And invariably, what will happen, the market will roll, you'll get a correction. How deep it is really will be, at this point, an unknown. But the 20 or 50 day moving averages are the most likely positions for the NASDAQ to pull back to. The S&P, not as overbought. We got weekly signals a week ago showing that excesses were in place. You do need a reversal, though, to kick in these weekly patterns. So, there's no rush to the downside. However, for traders, it's a good time to once again remind them to keep your stops nice and tight because there's a lot of, new money that is coming back into the market. And it's going to be very vulnerable once we do see a correction.
Is any of this action affecting the bond market?
Bond market has been just crashing around. Not a lot of big action there. Bonds are around 113 and a quarter. The top back in March was at 119 and change. Bottomed to 112 a month ago. And we've been double bottoming since then. So bond market, I would say, has not been reading anything into the news on equities or into what we've been seeing in the crude oil market. As a matter of fact, if you were to lay the crude oil and the bond market together, where you'd expect to see a bit of a run in the bonds when we've seen the correction in crude, that's not really happening. We've had a small bounce in bonds, but nothing to write home about at this point.
Now, crude, that's the one that's caught everybody's eye. How would you describe the week this time?
Okay, so, a week ago we were at 110, and getting ahead of ourselves on the upside, and you never knew what the use was going to be. It was a good day as far as the Strait of Hormuz was concerned, but so with oil, we dropped from 110 and we just kissed $90 here in the middle of this week. That was, from a technical perspective, that's exactly where the 50-day moving average is. And that's, a normal spot to have seen this pull back. What happens from here, who knows? We've had three attempts at 110 to 120. And now on the bottom end, we've got three attempts down at the 85 to 90 level. So let's call it a consolidation zone for now. And if we look at things like the HOI, as far as the stocks are concerned, there they've pulled back a bit. Nothing really dramatic so far, just enough to make people a little antsy. And I would expect that as we move along here, that the stocks in the sector here probably have got a deeper correction than we've seen so far.
What's going on with gold and silver?
Gold, silver, and platinum all bottomed about 2.5 weeks ago. We got sequential nine, so that's nine consecutive days with prices below 4 days earlier. And that pattern, say, happened in all three of the precious metals. And when you get that, you invariably get a pretty good bounce. We published a report saying that that should be an interim low. And so far, gold's rallied about 4%. Silver is up 14%, and the platinum's up 13%. We are up and approaching the highs that we had in April. And it would appear when we look at consolidations like this going back over the years that it would be not unusual to go up, take out the April highs, but not have a run to the upside. I think we've got a period of consolidation that we are we're into and probably will continue along this way for a while. Is that a few weeks or another month? Hard to say, but for now, the good bounce off the bottom was the easy one, and if anything, the traders could take some money off the table.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
We are stuck in the trading range, as you would expect, as far as the U.S. dollar is concerned, trading around 97 and change. We were at the same level 10 days ago. There had been a bounce to 99, but boy, here's another one. Nothing dramatic. The market had been down and tested a major support line there from 2020. We tested that in the early part of this year three different times and had a bounce, but the upside has been fairly limited. So there's no guidance in here. If anything, we have some short-term oversold signals. So, maybe it's enough that the 97 level will hold us for now. But as we've said for the last couple of weeks, I don't know that it really presents a trading opportunity to speak of.
What's Bitcoin doing?
Bitcoin, we did call the bottom on this quite nicely back in February, and then the retest of the low in April gave us new buy signals. That was all around 65,000. We're at 80,000 right now, and I still think that 85,000 is a pretty reasonable target on the upside. This is a good-looking double bottom. It's got a little bit of, forward methodical action to it. And that's the type of thing that can go on for an extended period of time. So for now, it's been a nice play, and we're going to enjoy staying with it.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
It's a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Eric Haddock, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Eric.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Eric, can you tell us a bit about Inside Track with Two Eyes and how our listeners can subscribe?
Yeah, InsideTrack is an advisory service that first and foremost focuses on the futures markets, but also flares out from there to cover stock indexes, precious metals, all your foreign currencies, both futures and we'll discuss the cash as well. But all of those markets viewed from a technical and cyclical perspective. We are a subscription-based publication set up, and your listeners can find out more information on our website at InsideTrackTrading.com. As you mentioned, that's with the extra I in the middle. So it's INSIIDE, TrackTrading.com.
The S&P 500 keeps hitting new highs while the Dow is close, but has not hit new highs yet. Is this normal in S&P 500 and Dow cycles?
Absolutely. It's normal in their day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month trading, depending on what sector of the market is really driving a move. And I do think that there are times when that type of divergence gives you a bit of a leading indicator of a market that's going through a transition. A perfect example was back in late October when the NASDAQ 100 topped, and subsequently in December, again in late January, and even in early February, when different indexes spiked to higher highs, the NASDAQ was always setting lower or equal highs, but it was not exceeding that late October peak. And that was kind of in sync with what I had been describing in our publications, that we should see a sharp sell-off in February and March, and that the last couple days of March and first couple days of April were when I expected a multi-month bottom to take hold. So since then, we've seen a strong rally, but I am watching that divergence you mentioned in the Dow Industrials, because there are multiple factors that some of them will become more apparent on the May 8th weekly close that would indicate to me that the overall market is starting a new topping process. But again, that's contingent on the Dow remaining below some key levels, regardless of what the S&P 500 and NASDAQ 100 do. But I do think it's worth watching. And really, we've had this the April surge and into early May on the backs of the tech and chip stocks, which primarily impacts the NASDAQ 100. And secondarily, the S&P 500, and hasn't quite had near as much an impact on the Dow Industrials.
Dow Jones Transports hit almost 25,000 in April, then pulled back to below 20,000. Is this volatility part of the transport cycle?
I would not say it's part of any cycle per se. I would say that it is 99% meme-like action in the CAR stock, Avis Budget Group. And if you watched what that did over a period of a couple of weeks, multiplying, I think, 8 or 10 times in value and then crashing back down, that's really what drove that move in the transports. But from a technical and cyclical perspective, as always, there were hints of that and leading indicators that I spelled out in early and mid-March, showing how the transports were the only index of the six that I follow closely that remained in a bullish weekly trend setup while those other indexes were in their February-March sell-offs. And the transports were also ones to bottom earlier on March 12th, 13th and give some buy signals right after that and then some more significant buy signals closer to the end of March. And so whereas I had no idea we were going to see that kind of, again, I can only call it meme-like action, meme stock action, in one of the components of the transports, the actual transportation average was showing that it was more bullish and was showing and was expected to lead the rally from the late March cycle lows. So it certainly gave indication of that, even if it didn't tell me exactly what was going to drive that surge.
Crude oil and Brent have been showing volatility. Are the cyclists predicting where the prices of crude and Brent are headed?
Well, the cycles and cycle progressions I use certainly give me strong indication of when to expect significant turning points. In between those turning points, those cycles have some impact, but it's some very specific technical price indicators that I rely on to really determine where I think they're heading and when they are entering transition phases, turning points. But ever since late 2025, I explained in my publications why January should begin a very inflationary cycle in overall commodities, and why that should be led by the energy markets. This was before any of the real perceived tensions were coming to the forefront with Iran, and the markets were already showing that all of the energy complex was due to bottom in January and then see at least a four-month surge from there. Contrasting that, or the opposing cycles and cycle progressions, told me to look for unleaded gas to wait until at least May before it would set a peak. And kind of a precursor to that, your energy stock indexes and ETFs, the XLE ETF and the XOI oil and gas index, were already showing signs of peaking in late March, and often you will get that type of divergence where the actual commodity, for lack of a better term, and that goes with precious metals, that goes with a lot of your other markets, but that will peak at a different time than the related stock indexes or mining share indexes in the case of precious metals. And so in this case, those oil and gas indexes were giving some indication that that the biggest move to the upside had run its course, but often a final peak doesn't take hold till quite a ways after that. So you're now ushering this first week of May is a critical time for me. I explained in my publications why May 4th, 5th was the latest phase of a very consistent daily cycle progression when a high was more likely. And that dovetailed with the monthly cycle progressions in unleaded gas that were also focused on the month of May for a potential top. So at least on a on a 1 to 2 week basis, and then seeing if that morphs into something bigger. I do think that the spike highs we just saw on May 4th and 5th, and reversal lower, should hold for, like I said, at least a couple weeks. And then there's certain signals that need to be generated during that 1 to 2 week period that then will tell me if it's a more significant, higher magnitude peak that is taking hold.
Natural gas surprisingly remains under $3. Is natural gas in a seasonality cycle?
Natural gas will often see a lot of its biggest surges in the hottest part of summer, whereas it used to just be related to extreme cold in winter. There's been just as much of a demand factor and a bullish factor on the price of natural gas from extreme heat and air conditioning related demand. And so it's not unusual to see it low at this point in time when you're beyond the extreme cold and you haven't quite reached extreme heat threats. So from a seasonality standpoint, that is pretty much what you would expect in natural gas. I have been watching the interplay or the slight divergence between natural gas futures and the UNG ETF. And it's been interesting to me that that ETF has been holding its January lows, which are a critical intra-year support level. And both the markets, the futures and that ETF, have given some short-term buy signals after bottoming in late April. But I need to now see a daily close above the May 4th, 5th highs to indicate to me that we've got at least a 2 to 4 week bottom and potentially something much more significant than that taking hold. So we're definitely in a very pivotal time where natural gas is concerned, and the price action is corroborating that. We just need to see some confirming signals to indicate that a bottom is intact.
Silver's been in a trading range for a while. What is the silver cycle likely to do next?
I have been saying all along that I was looking for a couple of significant time frames when I thought we would see successive peaks in all the metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium. And that has those time frames were in late January, again in late April, and we saw a very significant peak in late January, more of a secondary peak in mid to late April. But the two remaining time frames I'm focused on are in late July and late October. And so far, the technical indicators that I use have shown me that all we saw in January, February, I believe it was into early March, was an ABC correction of all of those metals, which tells you that there is another impulse wave, another advance that should exceed, at least meet, match, or exceed the late January highs still to come. And my weekly trend indicator was one of the key things indicating that. The only market that showed something a little different was palladium, but gold, silver, and platinum all showed the same signal in actually, it was towards the end of March, that when they spiked to a second low, lower low on the year, but did not turn the weekly trend down, and also dropped right to some critical longer-term averages that I follow as the kind of a final trend determinant. Everything was setting up for those metals to complete ABC corrections to the downside and to begin a new multi-month advance. And usually with, particularly with the precious metals, you don't see the accelerated moves until the later stages of those uptrends. So they could spend a fair amount of time tracing out the smaller level, smaller degree, smaller magnitude waves within that developing advance. And I think we've kind of seen that where you saw the first advance into mid-April and then the pullback into late April, early May. That could be a one and two wave of a developing larger magnitude advance. And so similar to what I was saying with natural gas, you need to see rallies above the recent highs. Now, in this case, I'm more focused on the mid-April highs in precious metals in order to confirm that we are in a more of an impulse wave, which simply means in the direction of the overriding trend, but more of an impulse than a corrective wave structure, and that those metals are likely to set significant highs towards the end of July and then towards the end of October. The more specific price expectations for those highs will likely become more in focus and better determined as the price action unfolds and as certain indicators start to collaborate with that and give more specific upside targets.
Gold's also been in a trading range for a while. What do you see ahead for the gold cycle?
Like I said, I see really gold, silver, platinum, and palladium pretty much doing the same thing and working their way higher. You have different times where gold's a little more bullish or bearish depending on geopolitical factors, and then times when silver's a little more influenced by economic factors. But I think in all of them, it's what I keep stressing to my readers over and over again, that factors like geopolitical uncertainty, like the war in Iran, factors like inflationary moves, like what we've seen in energy markets and the related commodity indexes, like the Goldman Sachs commodity index, they are secondary influences on gold and silver. And yet I will continue to have people ask me, why isn't gold and silver going up if this inflationary or if this geopolitical thing is surging? They're not the biggest driving factor. The biggest driving factor is interest rate expectations. And in particular, if you've got expectations for higher rates, that puts a weight on gold and silver. And if and when you get that perception that, okay, rates have peaked and they're likely to start coming down a little bit, that more underpins the price of gold and silver. And then you obviously have your specific demand factors that play a critical role in there as well. But once they have been factored in, it's that interest rate factor that really has the stronger influence compared to inflation expectations and compared to geopolitical uncertainty. That's even why, as you had your biggest surge in energy markets and inflation markets from late February into late March, you saw gold really take a hit, and that was partially because those inflationary factors all of a sudden started to question whether rates could start dropping as soon as people were expecting, then you start getting the expectation for rates to possibly hold steady for a much longer time, and even the possibility for rates to go up out in the future if those inflationary factors stayed elevated. And that was just another case in point of the impact it has on gold and silver. Gold saw its sharpest sell-off right there through the month of March. I guess it was about equivalent to the sell-off it saw in late January, early February. But a lot of that had to do with the burdensome factor of perceived interest rate hikes, or at least lack of interest rate cuts.
I'm sure you covered this. Platinum and palladium are in trading ranges. Where do you see the white metals going?
Yeah, I still think that what I said back in April of 2025, when I did a series of articles leading into that, and my April Inside Track newsletter last year, was saying how we were at a major bottom for the white metals, silver included, and that I thought we were going to see major bull markets take hold from there. The first stage was into early 2026, but I do think that there is another phase of that to come. So I think you are going to see another move up in platinum and palladium. I've started to detail some specifics for that in my publications, but I think there are some very clear cyclic timeframes when new bull markets could stretch into. So I do think that there is another round of buying to come in those white metals.
The U.S. dollar is trading in a range after putting in a bottom in late January. What do your cycles see ahead for the greenback?
I continue to think that the U.S. dollar set a major peak a couple years ago, and that it is tracing out a multi-year bear market. I thought that the month of March 2026 would see an intervening peak. There were several multi-month cycle progressions that aligned right then. And so then it was up to price action to corroborate those cycles. Sure enough, the dollar in its rally gave a textbook weekly trend failure signal, a little bit like what I was describing with precious metals and their lows. But that indicator and that sequence tells me that a market has stretched as far as it could go, but has done it in a corrective pattern. So in the case of the dollar, an upside correction to the overall downtrend. And I now am viewing that late March peak as the critical pivotal high for the dollar, secondary high. And I'm looking for a decline not only through this year, but into some longer term cycles that come out beyond this year. So that kind of fits with the potential in other markets like precious metals, although even that is not a 100%, 180 degree correlation, where dollar higher, gold, silver lower, or vice versa. That correlation also has a lot of nuance to it. But if I am correct and we've got interest rates kind of having the potential for some stability and even a little bit lower farther out this year, that could be one of those factors that starts to weigh on the dollar, but there are many other factors that I think will continue to put pressure on the U.S. dollar.
The Canadian dollar has been moving higher through April. Is the Canadian dollar bullish going forward?
I think the Canadian dollar has certainly been tracing out a bottoming phase since early last year, but it really needs to exceed the mid-year highs of last year of 2025, around 75 on the futures markets that I follow. Needs to exceed that level to show that this is some sort of higher magnitude bull market and not just a big trading range in a more negative structure.
Bitcoin's been moving higher through April. Is the Bitcoin cycle looking bullish?
I am still looking for cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Ether, some of the others, XRP, Solana, to set final lows, ideally in the month of May. I described in a couple of my publications where there are some synergistic weekly cycles coming into play towards the end of May in one of those cryptos. And to me, you look at the divergence there too, that Bitcoin is the only one of most of your primary cryptos that exceeded its April highs. Some of them haven't even exceeded their March highs. So you've got a little divergence working there too, that's reinforcing my outlook for a final spike low. But on a near-term basis, Bitcoin needs to drop below and close below its early May low in order to confirm that an intermediate top is in place and that perhaps terminal leg down is unfolding. I'd look for a daily and then weekly close below the 75,000 level as the real key, because there are a few indicators coming into play right around that price. So for me, that would be the more convincing signal that that Bitcoin's put in an intermediate top and that it's likely going to go back and retest its February lows.
With so much of the world's fertilizer-making materials trapped at the Strait of Hormuz, there's talk of coming food shortages. Are the agricultural cycles reflecting this?
To some degree, yes, they are in a bullish setup, whether that has to do with a fertilizer-related food shortage or a weather one or a shipping one. My work doesn't necessarily specify that, but looking at the grain markets in particular, they have been going through a multi-month bottoming phase, and the recent surges, and I've been looking for soybeans in particular, soybeans and corn, to pull back into the middle part of May before resuming their uptrends. But I certainly think there is the potential for what you're describing that has been reflected in the charts and in the technical action of those grain markets. So I'm continuing to watch that, and there's a couple of specific signals that would tell me we've elevated the magnitude and the degree of these rallies, and that those grain markets are entering a more dynamic phase to the upside.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money. And can you please tell us again how people can subscribe to Inside Track with Two Eyes?
Well, thank you for having me back, Jim. It's been a pleasure. And your listeners can find out more information about all the products we offer and a lot of archived reports on our primary website, insidetracktrading.com, and that's inside spelled with the extra I in the middle, INSIIDE, tracktrading.com.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and president of insidetracktrading.com. He was speaking to us from Central California. Coming up, Rick Ackerman, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website RickAckerman.com. He's speaking to us from South Florida. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for inviting me on, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
Rick, can you tell us a bit about your chat rooms and how people can subscribe to them?
Well, I'd love to. It's the heart of Rick's Picks is really the chat room. We've got some of the best traders in the world in that room, and it thrives on real-time information and guidance. For instance, I just put out one myself that I've got a $2.58 bid in for May 410 puts that expire next week in Microsoft. They're currently trading around $3.50, and their trades that go up that are for absolute beginners, people who have never made a dime trading options, and they also work for experts, of which there are many in the room. You can get in there for free, no credit card necessary, just by going to my homepage, rickackerman.com, and clicking on the free trial button.
Are volatile crude oil markets likely to continue, and are they good for trading?
Good for trading, yeah. I guess they sort of keep the market twitchy all of the time. And because it's chimpanzees who are running the markets, they're essentially throwing other people's money at a relative handful of stocks. They don't like to think about it, really, and simply being led around by the nose with crude oil prices as the determinant kind of simplifies it for them. Crude go up, chimpanzee sell. Crude go down, chimpanzee buy. But we've seen kind of a muted effect there because the market barely comes down when oil prices are rising, but stocks soar when oil prices are falling. So that just sort of follows the natural lunatic path of the market right now. It's in some sort of blow-off phase, I would say. And in that, I'm not alone. I keep up with some of the really good guys out there in the technical world, and I won't mention any names. Some of them are much more well-known than I am. But we all seem to be in agreement that we're in a topping process. And with the Elliott Wave guys, it's a question of how much of a correction we get now. And the correction is really the determinant of whether we're going to make a final high in the S&Ps above 8,000 or whether the top is going to be in the mid 7,000, currently trading at 7,422. That's the E-mini S&Ps.
The S&P 500 keeps hitting new highs, yet the Dow is not yet at new high territory. Any thoughts on why they're out of sync?
Well, it's because the chimps favor putting all the money, your money, into just a handful of stocks, and it's propelled the tech-heavy NASDAQ up into the ionosphere. The move has been almost 100. It's been almost vertical, and it's a sort of a simple decision when you're only looking at this relative handful of stocks. Because the stocks are so pricey, it's not as though widows and pensioners and mom and pop are going to be unloading. There's effectively no supply in these stocks. So they're only bought by institutions, but most of the big rallies, not most of them, virtually all of them occur on short covering. And that frequently comes when the chimpanzees, well, it's not actually the chimps, they're the portfolio managers, but to speak of the trade desk, the institutional trade desk, they spring a trap by bringing these stocks down. They pull the bids overnight, so the stocks simply fall until any conceivable seller has been exhausted. And then when the opening bell rings and there are no offers in sight, they'll gap stocks up. And these are some of the biggest cap stocks in the world. So when they gap a stock up like NVIDIA by $3 or $4 or $5, you're talking about tens of billions of dollars of quote unquote wealth effect that are being injected into the system. So that's how the game works.
Your thoughts on gold?
Well, it's gold and silver. As getting back to the old habit of testing the limit of the patience of gold bulls, and for a while there wasn't the same dynamic. You know, gold and silver were both making these huge leaps every day. But we've been in a corrective phase that was somewhat tricky. My subscribers, or certainly I, have a long position in silver right now, and it took me right down to a threshold where I was just about to bail out of it. So when I say it's testing us, that's what it's doing. Gold and silver have been pretty bullish over the last week or so, but I think this rally is limited. I believe we're going to come down correctively, and that better prices will be available for people waiting to buy gold or silver or augment existing positions.
Any thoughts on what's going on with copper?
Well, I don't follow copper too closely because it's been a lot trickier than it used to be. You know, there was we refer to copper futures as Doc Copper, and Doc Copper was supposedly a good indicator of global heavy activity like manufacturing, and I think that still applies, but there's also some craziness in the markets that seems to be a feature of all markets these days. Copper's currently trading at six, the futures, this is basis June, are at 627 a pound, and I think I can see potential up to around 691, so let's call it $7 just to get a round number out there. It's a bullish sign that copper's last pullback into, this would have been a low about a week ago, of $5.79, did not quite hit the place where I would like to be bidding on copper. So the fact that it's not weak enough to get me down to a stingy bid is indicative of strength. So I'd be looking for about 691 on the June COMEX contract.
Now, I just saw a recent interview that said perhaps copper won't be in as much of a demand. It's because they want to use optic fiber in data centers that are being built because it's faster and doesn't generate the heat the copper does. And glass is literally dirt cheap.
Yeah, it's so cheap that some of the drones that Iran is using use 10 to 15 miles of fiber optic cable to steer the drones without generating the kind of radio signal that would help the Israelis blow them out of the sky. So, yeah, it is cheap. But I heard that story 20 years ago. It was bearish on copper. The story was that all of Africa would have to get wired up for cell phone service and for phone service rather, and for telecommunications. But because that it was going to happen mostly with satellite signals, there wouldn't be that huge demand that you had for copper when the U.S. was building out its own copper network of wires. So there's always a kill shot story out there in the copper world, but I'm not going to believe it, because there, for every use of copper that goes by the wayside, another one kind of happens. It's a pretty useful metal.
Is Bitcoin likely to show strength as long as stock markets continue to show strength?
Yeah, it's kind of a go-along thing. Bitcoin currently at 80,400. I'm sorry, let me expose the actual price here. Currently, about $80,000. I've got an 86,000 target on it before it pulls back. So it's still a buy. That target has been in play for the last 12 or $13,000 of this rally. So anyway, yeah, it's got a little more play in it, but it's generally going to be a go. Sometimes when it's feeling a little feisty, in other words, very confident that stocks are going to simply go up, Bitcoin will lead the market, but it doesn't lead it speculatively the way it used to.
What are your thoughts on more and more people becoming billionaires?
There are just too many of them, you know. A billion still seems like real money when you think of all the nice things it can buy. But because so many of the billionaires are becoming billionaires on the movement of stock and shares that they acquired as insiders for pennies that have been bid into the ionosphere, I think it's going to wind up being easy come, easy go, or not so easy go. And a lot of billionaires who are there on paper may experience the same end that a lot of millionaires did in 1929. So, but if you, I saw that somebody on the internet published as a picture of $1 trillion, and there were these pallets of, they were all loaded with $100 bills, and it was a huge thing, like I don't know how many football fields, but for scale, they had an 18-wheeler truck, and it was just this tiny little thing at the corner of this whole bunch of pallets. So $1 trillion is a lot of money, and that's no longer out of sight because that's going to be Elon Musk's payoff if he achieves all of the goals that he agreed to, or that the board agreed to for Tesla. But I think relative to what he's capable of producing in terms of capital growth for Tesla and SpaceX and the merged entity, $1 trillion is going to wind up being a great deal for the board and for Tesla shareholders.
Is the private loan market in trouble?
I keep reading about that, and I guess it is, but we don't seem to be seeing a collapse. It's like a watch pot. The more we talk about it, the more it tends to put off whatever the consequences will be from this this private credit thingy. It is a lot of credit extended has to do with AI bets. Everybody's got some kind of AI gizmo they're peddling. And there's no shortage of private equity money and private loans to be thrown at these ideas. While I think of it, I had a fantasy about it. Somebody who comes on Shark Tank with a great new AI gizmo, and what it does is when you receive a spam phone call and you hit the word. You hit the dismiss call button, the spammer dies of pancreatic cancer. It can't miss in the marketplace.
Although today we're told AI has now come up with a cure for spotting pancreatic cancer in stage one. Maybe your magic bullet doesn't work. Can you foresee a day where so many people have been displaced by AI that they storm these AI data centers hoping to destroy them and get their jobs back?
Well, there's a bit of a groundswell already against the data centers. I can't remember which particular town and which boondock was about to get one of the backers was Kevin Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank, and he was in there pitching it the other day, and he had a he had a torch mob that came out for this meeting. There were hundreds of people from this, wherever the locality was, where they want to build a data center that is so huge. I mean, again, to put it in terms of football fields, it was more football fields than I could imagine. It was as big as, I think it was made, it was three times as big as Manhattan, if you can imagine a data center that big. So it's no wonder that people there, let's see, it was in the state of, I think it was Utah. And the people in this particular area of Utah were not only concerned about their township, but all of Utah with respect to pollutants. And at that scale, it doesn't matter if the essence of it hardly pollutes at all. When you've got something as big as three Manhattans, it's gonna change your air quality and your water quality and everything else, and it'll certainly change whatever you thought was nice about that area of Utah or the Southwest for that matter. So yeah, we've already got some heat there and some opposition to the data centers, because there's still this question about, will they all be used? You know, will we ever draw that much power, and who will be drawing it, and what will they be doing? You know, they'll be out of work, of course, because AI will put them out of jobs. So where does the market come from? People who can pay money for whatever the output is of these huge AI centers. I have to confess, I don't get it.
Around the world, except in North America, people have accepted electric vehicles because they have been paying sky-high gasoline prices for a long time, mostly due to taxes. Now, Americans are seeing the kind of gasoline prices that we've been paying in Vancouver the last 10 years. Do you think EVs will become popular?
That's such a fickle thing, you know. It's like which month of the year it flip-flops so horrendously. And of course, the big trend, all the big car manufacturers, with the exception of Toyota, went all in on EV, and then they came to regret it. Nobody was buying EVs because of, well, for one, the battery life problem, and if you're really on the road, like taking a long summer trip, it's just easier to gas up, and people just like their big combustion engine powered SUVs. So, and we can go all the way back, you know, 30, 40 years, when oil prices fluctuated to the extent that when gasoline went up to, God forbid, $1.80 a gallon or something, that we have this shift into smaller cars, and it turned out that the manufacturers can't make money producing and selling smaller cars. That's why everybody drives a Chevy Suburban these days. But so, all right, so to your question about are EVs going to get more popular, they'll be popular for 6 days. And if crude oil prices stay high, yes, it's going to slowly feed into the EV market, and I guess somewhat revive its prospects. But you know, it's unpredictable, I think, as to what crude prices are going to do. I think from my charting standpoint, that this little pullback we had into the high 80s was just a temporary relief, and I do have a target up around 128, which would be $33 above where NYMEX crude is trading at this moment. So get ready for another surge and some more fickle demand for EVs. It may happen.
One of the ways China, I think, is driving the popularity of electric vehicles is that they can make them cheaply because their factories are 99% robots. They don't have labor costs.
That's true. I mean, they can make them so cheaply that even if Trump
he applies a 200% tariff before the courts knock it down. Even with the 200% tariff, the Chinese could probably, they'll still manage to compete. You know, they'll sell a car, they'll sell an EV for $6,000 or something, and you triple the price to 18, and it still winds up being a deal. So yeah, and that, speaking of Chinese factories manned by robots, we've talked about this before, but whenever Trump talks about a resurgence in the manufacturing sector, it has to be, in order to be competitive, it has to be a humanless factory, and that's what's coming. And to extend, since I'm mentioning Trump, let me say something I wanted to talk about with you today, and that is what is going to cause the stock market to collapse. And that's the way I don't think this bull market, now into its 17th year, is going to end gently. But I think it will be disillusionment with Trump. I think he's going to lose his credibility. In some ways, I love the guy. He's done more than any other president anybody can remember. And a lot of it is good stuff. But he bit off more than he can chew with this idea of affordability. He's going to make things affordable. We've got so much inflation that's still in the pipeline based on what it's costing diesel trucks to bring us all the stuff we consume, there's a huge surge in inflation up ahead. And on the other front, the war front, we've discovered that we're in a war that we can win it in a conventional sense. We can absolutely obliterate Iranian infrastructure, including what they use to produce weapons, but we're never going to get the jihadis, the mullahs, to surrender, to concede defeat. So we'll have to declare it unilaterally, but it will be with their still being in possession of a pretty good quantity of highly enriched uranium, and also possibly not even a surrender in the Strait of Hormuz. So it's one thing to declare victory, but it's somewhat in doubt that we're going to achieve just the goals, really, of opening up the Strait and of getting Iran to give up its uranium stockpile. But I think it's pretty clear that they're never going to take a knee. They're never going to say we give up. And I think who was it? We're talking an old timer, not Orwell. But anyway, the idea was that mutually assured destruction used to prevent wars and be generally a beneficial thing, but it's actually an incentive for the jihadis to make war, because if the other guy gets destroyed and a few of them survive, then they win. So this is going to increasingly impact on Trump's credibility, that every day he sort of comes up with a new way in which we're winning, or we won, or we're going to crush them again and again and again. But I have to say, most unfortunately for the world, the jihadi spirit, such as it is indomitable.
Yes, when people are willing to strap on suicide vests and jump into your car or into your church, you're in trouble, when people aren't scared to die.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. They aren't scared to die. It's an honor to die. And of course, when you're dead, you have those however many, 67 virgins, 73 virgins, 81 of them. But there's that reward. And we'll never see. Iran's never going to concede.
The only way would be boots on the ground, isn't it?
And Trump is definitely not having any of that for good reason. We're not going to put boots on the ground, because then it becomes really just, and manifestly obvious to all, just another one of those forever wars.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
I would say if you want some peace of mind, you might avert your eyes from the stock market. It's just nutty. And as I was saying earlier, it just sort of it follows every twitch in oil prices. And that's pretty much how smart it is. It thinks like it has a pea brain, which it does. And I don't mean, I mean, collectively, you take every brain on Wall Street and roll them into one ball. It would be like the size of it'd be like a BB rolling down an 8-lane highway.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us and being on This Week in Money.
Thanks very much for having me on, Jim. I really enjoyed our chat today.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Eric Haddock, and Rick Ackerman. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.